This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, February 13th. I'm Eric Latch, a staff writer at The New Yorker, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. Two states have now voted in the 2020 presidential race, Iowa and New Hampshire. In Iowa, a year-long campaign that featured dozens of candidates, clashes over the future of the Democratic Party, and plenty of old-school, flesh-pressing retail politics ended in chaos. An underprepared state party and a malfunctioning iPhone app caused delays in reporting the results, which in any case were maddeningly close. In the end, Bernie Sanders had won the popular vote in Iowa, while Pete Buttigieg had, because of the rules of how the Iowa caucuses work, captured more of the state delegates. This week's New Hampshire primary, mercifully, had a clearer outcome. Sanders won there, closely followed by Buttigieg, with a strong third-place finish from Amy Klobuchar. In declaring victory in New Hampshire, Sanders extended an olive branch to his Democratic opponents.
And tonight, I want to take the opportunity to express my appreciation and respect for all of the Democratic candidates we ran against. Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden. And what I can tell you with absolute certainty, and I know I speak for every one of the Democratic candidates, is that no matter who wins, and we certainly hope it's going to be us, we are going to unite together. We are going to unite together and defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
Ben Wallace Wells, a New Yorker staff writer, was in New Hampshire to report on the primary there and joins me to discuss the state of the race. Ben, welcome.
Thanks. It's been an interesting week.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe that's the place to start. Many people, the candidates, the party, voters, were hoping that once voting actually started, we'd start getting answers to some of the big questions that this whole campaign has raised. But after two states, it seems like we've just kind of replaced some questions with other questions, and that the answer stage is still a long ways off. I mean, does that strike you as the right read?
Yeah, basically. I mean, and you know, with Mike Bloomberg looming, with his $350 million spent on television advertising already, we may soon be replacing the old candidates with new candidates without really resolving much. I do think that you know, one thing that we can say pretty clearly after these first two states is Bernie Sanders has the single, you know, most formidable operation in the field. He looks like a pretty distinct front runner. And I think that one thing that was notable, and I'm curious whether you saw this in Iowa, where you were for a month or so, is that while, you know, James Carville and other Democratic establishment figures and political pundits were showing up on Morning Joe over the last month, decrying Sanders' advance and sort of trying to rally the party against him, I heard very little of that from voters. You know, there are plenty of voters who were not that excited by Bernie.
Yeah.
And we're deciding between Warren and Buttigieg and Klobuchar.
Yeah.
But there wasn't an effort to like rally the party against him that felt anything like the one that you saw in the media. Did you find that in Iowa too?
Yeah, I mean, and that's something I encountered just from conversations in Iowa, but it's also something that people are starting to see reflected in sort of broader polling numbers too, right? That Democratic voters feel by and large like pretty good about the people running, whereas pundits and obviously the campaigns themselves see the distinctions between the candidates as a lot more like conflictual, right? And I guess maybe that's a way to sort of talk about what's ahead for Sanders. I mean, I think one of the big questions that people are asking about Sanders this week is, can he broaden his support beyond the quarter of the party who is clearly sort of firmly behind him? You know, what we were just talking about, that people feel by and large good about the candidates, good about Sanders, maybe suggests that that's one way that he could potentially broaden his appeal.
Yeah, I think that caveat to that we began to see in New Hampshire is that the most obvious place for him to draw support beyond his base is from those voters who picked Elizabeth Warren, whose first preference was Elizabeth Warren. You know, somewhat surprisingly to certainly the political press and a lot of close observers, Warren, who for a long time appeared to be sort of the natural unity candidate, bridge candidate between the Sanders faction and the kind of Obama legacy part of the party, has really faded over the last couple of months to the point where, you know, Amy Klobuchar, almost doubled her vote in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
But though you would think that because Warren echoes many of Sanders' sort of policies, though they're kind of in agreement in their basic progressive orientation, there isn't much evidence yet that, like, Warren's voters, when they desert her, are going over to Sanders.
Yeah, I mean, what did you make of, I mean, that was, you know, I think to the Sanders campaign's frustration, that was one of the things that the media observed after New Hampshire is Sanders won with about 26% of the vote, and then if you total up everybody else, you know, the majority of voters did not vote for Sanders. What do you make of that breakdown at this stage?
I may be a little bit more cautious than some of the other pundits who think that this, you know, suggests that there's a big centrist wave to come. When I talk to voters at Klobuchar events and at Buttigieg events and at Biden events, you know, and when I talk to supporters of Mike Bloomberg's, their reasons for supporting the candidates are quite different. You know, there's like a kind of, you know, glossy hopefulness about Pete Buttigieg's campaign. You know, there's a kind of like entrenched working class, you know, outlook to Joe Biden's campaign. Many of Elizabeth Warren's supporters and Amy Klobuchar's feel very strongly that, you know, after 45 consecutive men, a woman should be elected president. You know, the depressing part of that for those voters, the depressing part of the New Hampshire results and to a certain extent the Iowa results, is it's beginning to seem a little bit less likely, you know, that voters in states that vote, you know, a couple months down the line will have a realistic option of voting for a woman who might win the presidency.
Yeah, I mean, so what do you make of Klobuchar cementing a kind of third place role in this race this late? Like, what does that mean to sort of go from fifth, sixth, seventh on a long list of candidates to like third place? But Super Tuesday is just a couple weeks away, and you know, so what is this position for her?
Well, I think it's a sort of uncertain one. On the positive side, I think what you would say is there are like real reasons that voters might end up with Amy Klobuchar, though it seems like it sort of happened in this kind of spasm of two media cycles at the end of New Hampshire. You know, from the beginning, there were some obvious things that were appealing to her. Most centrally, she doesn't mess up like the essential dynamic that many Democrats want, which is just to point at Donald Trump and have the general election be about judging him. You know, she doesn't have many policy ideas. She certainly doesn't have many controversial policy ideas. Part of the seduction of Biden at first and then Bloomberg is that you might just have a candidate who could sort of stand still and let Donald Trump whirl himself into a kind of crazed state on the other side of the podium. Socialism complicates that. Medicare for all complicates that. There's something for Trump to point at. There's not much there with Klobuchar. And then two, you know, the thing that she was pointing to as a kind of closing argument is, hey, I've won in purple states. I won Michelle Bachmann's conservative district in Minnesota 3 times. Like, you know, if what we're looking for is a candidate who has appeal to voters in the Midwest who might flip Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania to the Democrats, like, you got to be crazy to ignore the person who's done it. So there's like reasons to vote for Klobuchar. On the other side of the spectrum, this is a really thin candidacy. She doesn't have a ton of money. The kind of questions that have been asked of every single other non-Biden candidate about whether they have any real appeal to Black and Brown communities, the voters from those communities, are like very present with Klobuchar. She hasn't demonstrated any of that appeal either.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, Buttigieg, I mean, we haven't really talked about yet, his campaign also was about the early states. You know, they had a theory that, like, you have to do well in Iowa and New Hampshire to move forward in a campaign, especially with a candidate who's, you know, started out as unknown. And now they have. And yet, ultimately, like, the thing that was identified early on as his big challenge of winning over Black voters and Hispanic voters and voters in big states that weren't predominantly white, that he might just not be able to do that or is not showing signs that he is doing that yet.
What Buttigieg had to sell in this campaign was basically himself. He wasn't really selling a factional wing of the party. In fact, he kind of, like, you know, went a little bit back and forth. At first, he seemed to be heading in a more progressive direction. Now he's sort of pretty fixed as a centrist. I think his real genius, and I don't use that word lightly, is being able to show a different side of himself to embody, to find a way that his own experience can embody an experience that the country is going through. And the challenge that South Carolina poses for him, that Nevada poses for him, that black and brown voters pose for him, is that the experience is further away from his own, you know? And I watched him in Atlanta around a debate in November, reaching out to black audiences and trying to connect. And the moves that were just clicking so well in New Hampshire and Iowa just were falling flat, you know? And, you know, I think that another aspect here is he's kind of seemed to annoy all of the other Democratic candidates, you know? I mean, Klobuchar, really what she did, I mean, she talked about Sanders a bit in that debate on Friday that seemed to, like, catapult her in New Hampshire. But really, she seemed to have a kind of disgust for the fact that, like, this guy who nobody had heard of had somehow claimed the mantle of Midwestern centrist. Biden also, you know, like, you know, there have been reports that he mocks him and calls him the president. If we are looking at a scenario in which no candidate has a majority of support among Democratic voters, then a real, you know, determining factor is who has the goodwill of their opponents and their supporters. And Buttigieg is, you know, is a little bit out there on his own.
To change gears here, I want to talk about where Joe Biden is. For the whole summer and into the fall, the national polls had him ahead. There were signs that his candidacy was kind of more brittle than it looked, but the undeniable fact all of 2019 was that he was leading in the polls. You know, now he, in these first two states, yeah, didn't do well. He left New Hampshire before the results even came in on Tuesday to fly down to South Carolina, you know, which has long been considered a place where he is well positioned to do well or win. You know, but part of this is all these kind of questions about the specific candidates are kind of all part of the same question, which is just like, when is this field going to get smaller? When is the Democratic Party going to end up with a kind of A or B choice as opposed to an A, B, C, D, E, F choice? And sort of where do you think Biden fits in that question right now?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, there were reports a couple of days ago that he might not even be able to pay for a private jet to fly him around to the Super Tuesday states. It is hard to imagine, you know, the presumed strength of Biden's candidacy, as you said, was in the South. And the South votes now. It votes in South Carolina on February 28th. It votes across the South on Super Tuesday, just a few days after that. And it is, you know, basically impossible for me to imagine Joe Biden quitting before that. But, you know, having seen him on Monday at a couple events in New Hampshire, in a mode in which he was, you know, enjoying himself a little bit more maybe, but no longer really even trying to go after Sanders and Buttigieg, it didn't look to me, at least in that moment, like this is a candidacy that is long for this earth. Warren had a sort of defiant speech on Tuesday night where she said, we are in this for the long haul. Her campaign put out a 2,000-word memo, you know, explaining all the ways that she might win in states to come, how she was well-positioned. Didn't hear anything like that from Biden. It does seem like he might be the candidate who drops out next. And if that's true, then the question of the voters that he was presumed to have the loyalty of, especially older African-American voters, that becomes, you know, very important.
And then stepping into all this is Michael Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor, who declared his candidacy late, decided to skip the first four states, and is showing up in the polls, is spending hundreds of millions of his own dollars. I think he's hired over 2,000 staff members, and he's basically just throwing money at every problem that a presidential candidate faces. You know, whether there's a sort of big, I think, debate about whether on a practical level there's a kind of path for him to win enough delegates to claim the nomination through the Democratic Party process. But I think what he's showing is just like you can be a presidential candidate very, very quickly if you have enough money, I guess, if you're able to resource yourself quickly enough. You know, the thing that hasn't happened yet is at some point, does he come into contact with the rest of the field? You know, it's like, does that happen after voting starts? Does he end up on debate stages? Nobody seems to quite know what to do with him.
I don't know how Mike Bloomberg is going to campaign maintain exactly once it gets a little bit more necessary for him to be a human presence and not just one on television and, you know, digital advertising. He is not a retail guy. You know, I interviewed him a couple of times and he was mayor of New York. You know, there's a distance and a kind of weirdness there that is very palpable. Not only that, but like he has this kind of, you know, helpful way of centering the kind of essential subject of the liberal left for the last decade, which is inequality and, you know, collections of capital and their kind of perverting effect on the democratic process. It is a little bit hard for me to understand exactly how he creates a movement around himself. I think that the essential feeling that has to exist, the kind of precondition for him to be president, is a kind of panic. Bloomberg is somebody who is not going to ideologically offend centrist voters, who has a pretty plausible claim that he could win the same kind of coalition that helped power the Democrats in the 2018 midterms, heavily suburban, not obviously antagonistic to wealth, and he can compete on resources with Trump. It's hard for me to see a great, beloved, positive, you know, movement of the kind of grassroots sort that we were talking about with Warren or Sanders or Obama coming together behind Mike Bloomberg.
And so I guess the place I want to end is back with Sanders, who I think the term that was in debate in the media all week is like front runner. What does it mean? And who can we apply it to? But I think it's undeniable at this point that Sanders has assembled the most amount of the pieces that you need to sort of move on towards a nomination. I guess my question for you is just sort of what you'll be looking at in terms of how he presents himself and his campaign, how his campaign presents itself as we move forward here.
You know, I think we still have this sort of, you know, dreamy kids vibe around the Sanders campaign, and that's gone. You know, in the actual experience of the Sanders campaign, this is a really impressive machine. The ads are good. The economic message is like crystal clear. The way that they use surrogates and left-wing media is extremely impressive. Their fundraising is a juggernaut. And I think the big question for Sanders is anybody else who doesn't like him already going to flock to his banner? And I think in some ways, you know, the entrance of Bloomberg is an extremely disruptive presence. But if the choice comes down to Sanders and Bloomberg, you know, it really much more directly, you know, prompts liberals who might be, you know, somewhat torn to say, look, is it okay to have a billionaire just kind of drop in over this party after all the talk of inequality that we have been having and kind of committed to over the last decade? Is this where it ends, you know? And so I think, like, though Bloomberg's entrance into the race is potentially threatening, there's also a way in which, you know, I think Sanders' team would welcome that contrast.
Yeah, it's a clarifying contrast. Right. Ben, thanks.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Ben Wallace Wells is a staff writer at The New Yorker, writing about American politics and society. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.